has been a while since we last, we did our live Halloween episode.
That was a pretty good episode.
That was fun.
That was, like, long.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our fly on the wall recording session. This time, we're back. Victor and I are back in a formal environment.
With a cough.
Are you feeling all right?
I'm feeling all right, but you're probably going to hear those.
You're going to be like a General Grievous.
Like, edit it out, right?
It's nice to see you again, my friend.
It was nice to see you, even though we saw each other
last weekend.
Week.
Yeah,
Hollywood.
Yeah, in Hollywood.
Crazy shit went down.
Yeah, we're here. thank you, everybody, for joining us for this episode of Planet Celluloid. We are going to be focusing on the film Interstellar by director Christopher Nolan, which opened last weekend, or actually, no, it opened last week in IMAX. If any of you had the privilege of seeing it in 70mm IMAX, it was out on Tuesday, right?
Yes.
Yeah, on the 4th. The movie didn't officially open wide until Friday, but we got to see it Sunday morning at the TCL Chinese Theater in 70mm IMAX. So
a medium crowd, right?
We went 8 in the morning. Sunday, 8 in the morning, but there was a lot. I was surprised.
Yeah, there was a lot.
There was a lot of people there because of our busy, busy schedules. So,
which I have to say is the best time to go, by the way.
There was no traffic
everywhere. Quiet. No weirdos in Hollywood.
It was empty.
It was.
It was very apocalyptic.
Very. By Hollywood standards.
Yeah, we were living the film.
Because we went to go see Gravity at night.
Yeah, but also the night that we went.
Was it a Friday? I don't remember.
We went Saturday night. Yeah, we went to Saturday. It opened.
Oh,
and
yeah,
also, right. That bastard John Mayer had a concert happening at the Hollywood Bowl. So there was more traffic than usual.
A lot of people there, too.
Yeah. Damn it, John Mayer. So we're going to skip over movie news, and we're going to go straight into our recent release.
Which, by the way, you have a really good story that you should talk about.
Is it about the
new Bev?
Oh,
that is
okay.
It implicates Tarantino.
All right, yeah. Okay, I guess we do have one piece of news, which is also part of my recently seen, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm wondering if... I'll just hold off on that one for right now.
I haven't
now.
Been to the new Bev, by the way.
Me neither.
Which I want to go, but he's protesting it.
Dude, I'm not stopping. You can go if you want. It's just I'm kind of really, really sad I'm not going to be able to go.
Mm-hmm. Ever? Like, so it's off the table.
Until they... like speak about it, it's off the table. Mm-hmm. Or unless they pay me, I don't know. So yeah, let's go straight into our recently seen. I love this. So Victor, what have you seen lately?
The last movie I saw was a movie called Sunlight Junior. It's with Naomi Watts and Matt Dillon. Independent movie. Not really good. In fact, I don't think it's that good that it's even worth talking about. It's like about these like really poor couple living in Florida, and then she gets pregnant and they like she has, like, a minimum wage job, so, yeah. That's the movie.
Is that really it?
Yeah.
There's no gimmick to it? Like, they inherit $100 million or something?
No. There's nothing. Can I spoil it?
That's really it?
She aborts the baby at the end.
Oh. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert to a movie not worth watching. Very underdeveloped.
As you said, you saw this on Amazon Prime?
Amazon Prime, I did.
Okay. Wow.
I'm pretty sure I've seen more, but that's the only one that I remember.
Mm-hmm. That's worth talking about.
It's so bad. Well, because I'll watch anything with Naomi Watts in it, but I thought this movie was pretty bad.
Who directed it?
I don't even know. It was really independent, really low budget. Like, even Naomi Watts didn't look like she belonged there. Like, she was, like, doing a favor for someone.
Was this a paycheck movie?
Oh, probably not.
Was it just that low budget that it's, like, a paycheck?
The art movie? But it's pretty bad.
How old is it?
It's from last year, actually.
Really?
But it's because it's, like, so underdeveloped. Like, you don't really get development in any of the story that, by, like, the end, you really don't care about anything.
Mm. How long is it?
Like, an hour and 30 minutes.
Wow.
Juno was better, by the way.
You know, actually, I never saw that.
Oh, you never saw Juno? Juno's all right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure you've seen a lot of movies.
You got through Twin Peaks.
I did get through Twin Peaks.
This must be noted. Victor went through the entire 2 seasons of Twin Peaks and Fire Walk With Me. What did you think of Fire Walk With Me?
Bizarre. It's very interesting because we talked about this. Twin Peaks seems like people who started watching it probably like lost interest by the end. Because it appealed to like a specific fan base that by the end it was kind of just like movie geeks watching it.
I agree with that one. I was really curious to see what you'd think because my impression of Twin Peaks, and I guess since we're a movie podcast, let's focus on Fire Walk With Me.
Mm-hmm.
My impression after finishing the, and what we saw was the awesome, awesome Twin Peaks, the entire mystery box set, which is absolutely worth picking up if
mm-hmm.
you could ever get a good deal on it, because it's a little pricey. The Fire Walk With Me film really seemed like a David Lynch movie.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the TV show had a lot of humor in it. It was very much that soap opera parody that they were setting out to make. But by the time we got to Fire Walk With Me, it was a straight David Lynch film.
It was almost like a horror movie, even.
Yeah, that's definitely the most like horror-esque type of movie he's made, I think. Or at least that I've seen to this point. I haven't seen his entire filmography. But it was really, really terrifying, especially all that shit with like Killer Bob and
mm-hmm.
and Leland Palmer,
the dad.
I don't want to spoil it with for any of you, because it is really worth watching. It is, there are only so many episodes of Twin Peaks because the show didn't last very long, and the movie is, the common assumption or acceptance for the film is that it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't very well received by critics or audiences, and this movie was a major, major bomb when it opened in theaters. I think now the tide is starting to turn a little bit. It's being more accepted by both Twin Peaks fans and
mm-hmm.
David Lynch fans. I personally really dug it, but it is a radical, radical departure from the show. It's as if David Lynch decided to do the show, but completely take all the humor out of it.
Mm-hmm. Even there's a David Lynch cameo in it. And his like role is like out of place because he's trying to be funny, but the film's like so...
Agent
so
Dale
dark.
Cooper! Yeah, it is a really, really dark movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, his cameo is totally out of place. But even then, the Gordon Cole character is just really loud. Like, he's not particularly
mm-hmm.
funny, or he just serves to tell the audience that they're stupid. I got that impression when he does the thing where Chris Isaac has to explain to Kiefer Sutherland all, like, decoding all of his cryptic hand gestures. And then he
yeah.
does the one where he puts his hand over his face. I believe that's David Lynch having to blatantly spell it out for the audience and telling them that they're stupid. That's just personally that's what I think. But
it is a really bizarre movie, but like now that I'm thinking about it, there's a lot of like really good moments in it. See, when it comes to David Lynch, I'm more interested in seeing him like seeing his craft than like the actual like plot,
the actual
craft, plot of the movie. Like there's that scene in the with David Bowie.
Oh, right.
Remember he like, what is it?
He plays the guy who escaped the Black Lodge, like the former FBI
mm-hmm.
agent.
And then he like, there's like a scene where like there's a security camera and then Cooper's watching it. Then he like goes out and then there's like a time lapse or something.
Uh-huh.
A time delay.
Yeah.
It's such a weird scene. I don't even know what the point of that
scene was. I didn't even really understand it.
But I thought like
seeing
Lynch do Lynch, you know, is pretty interesting.
But the thing with that is that box set takes the 90 minutes of deleted scenes from the Fire Walk With Me movie, and it includes them in the box set. It doesn't edit them back in. Some people have actually started to make their own fan edits of the
mm-hmm.
film. So I believe you can find those online. Like, you can find those bootlegs online where somebody has, like, an extended Fire Walk With Me where it's drawn out to, like, about 3 hours.
It's a really long movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the movie itself is only
an
hour and a half.
Yeah. But with the edits.
To
film that, I think.
So they filmed a crap ton, and 90 minutes of it wasn't even used. And apparently that's all of what they shot. So
mm-hmm.
everything they shot is on this Blu-ray.
What do you rate it?
I think it's a solid 7. There's a lot of stuff wrong with it, though. I mean, it's not the show.
It's not the show.
And after experiencing the show, you really want it to be the show. But
see, it's interesting that you say that, because... as I saw the Twin Peaks, I think for me the best episodes were when it wasn't being funny. You know, when it wasn't being a parody. Like when then there's like that scene.
Spoiler
where,
alert. The show's been out for 20-some years. If you haven't seen it by now, you're making a huge mistake.
And then there's that scene where like the girl singing that woman. That song that she's playing.
Are you talking about at the club?
At the club, yeah. It's during the Maddie murder scene.
Okay.
And then those weird scenes with what do you call it? Like his hotel room?
Oh, the...
His lodge or whatever.
The Great Northern.
Yeah, he's in that room, and then like he sees the vision of that tall man.
The
that weird like skinny butler.
That freaked me the hell out.
You know, that's why, like, for me, that's what I found interesting about Twin Peaks, is that it varied a lot in tone. But to me, like, the best parts of it were when it was Lynch being Lynch.
And my favorite episodes of the show were the ones that he directed. Mm-hmm. But I still think the first episode is so good. The first one and the last one. Like, the last, I thought after they solved Laura Palmer's murder and the show became about Wyndham Earle, I really, really lost interest. I just thought it meandered and it kind of felt like it had a direction to go in, but they didn't really know what road to take. Mm-hmm. And then in the last episode, they totally brought it back around and it was extremely freaking good.
The last episode was so good.
And then they got canceled.
That was a Lynch episode, right?
I believe it was a Lynch episode, the last episode. They got canceled. Yeah, so it looks
that's kind of like cool. Well, like interesting about those shows also is that like the single concept show is like you run out of episodes once you run out of the
murder was just a way to bring all of these characters together so that they could start to tell the stories of these people that live in Twin Peaks, and then I guess everybody just became so infatuated with the Laura Palmer murder, which really is the central storyline, that when that went away in season two, everybody was kind of like, well, what the hell? I think though, if they dropped the ball for any reason, it's that they didn't move away from that sooner.
That I think that's probably the problem was.
If we would have had something even like bigger come up that wasn't Laura Palmer related in one of the early episodes of season two, I think people would have been a lot warmer to like the Wyndham Earle type thing to doing whatever. But because it was so Laura Palmer central and all these characters were involved deeply in her life and her murder, that when the show suddenly was no longer about Laura Palmer, it was just kind of like, what the hell is this?
Because they really all were focused about that girl.
Mm-hmm. But I guess we'll find out in 2 years what happened.
Shooting.
Yeah. Twin Peaks is coming back on Showtime. Well, anyways, that was an awesome... So,
I like the show. So I get
awesome show. What did you? Oh, just I guess to end it. Out of 10, what do you give Firewalk with Me?
7. Also
7. 7. Yeah, that's definitely.
But the experience is so mesmerizing, though.
Yeah, it was. That's an.
I have like high praise for it.
Yeah, last week I saw The Dark Knight. In anticipation for Interstellar. I was going to rewatch more of Nolan's films, but The Dark Knight was the only one I got to because it had been a long time since I've seen it from beginning to end. So it was on Sunday, we saw Interstellar. Tuesday night, I watched Nightcrawler
with you saw Jake
Gyllenhaal. Yeah, I saw it. Oh, man, it was so good. He's so creepy. He's just so downright creepy in that film. Just his look and his mannerisms and the actual story itself. It's such an eerie, like uncomfortable story, or he's such an uncomfortable character in that movie. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those like total transformation type roles where it's Gyllenhaal, but he does this thing where like he's listening to you and he's just kind of like wide-eyed staring off into space, and it was just really freaky. And I actually thought I really enjoyed the film. I thought the story was nothing special, but his performance makes it something special. Like the film deals with sort of pseudo-journalists called Nightcrawlers. And these guys have police scanners and camera equipment, and they're just listening for, like, murders and car accidents and all these things. They go and film them, and they hopefully get good enough footage that they go to TV stations or out media outlets and try to sell it to them. And Gyllenhaal sort of is a thief just by accident, or just by circumstance, comes up on an accident, and he meets these guys, one of which is played by Bill Paxton, who I had no clue was in the movie. Mm-hmm. So it was a nice surprise to see him there. And he totally plays a dude bro. He says brah quite a few times in the film.
It's a funny word.
Yeah. But so I saw Nightcrawler, and just last night I watched Rosewater, which is Jon Stewart's directorial debut. With Gael García Bernal was in that.
Okay, how was that?
I actually liked that one too. I'm lucky; I've yet to see a bad movie this week, and I have two coming up on Netflix. So I hopefully, they're
which
not
turns out.
I have a Snowpiercer and The Double by Richard Ayoade.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm catching up on my 2014 picks. So hopefully next month we'll have for you all.
Is on Prime also, Ida?
Which one is that?
That black and white movie about that woman who has like a Nazi secret or something.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with
that. You've talked about it.
Did I really?
You probably have to like Google it later. But that one's on Amazon.
Okay. Well.
She's like a Catholic girl. It's in black and white.
I'm trying to blank. But anyway.
That one's on there, yeah.
That Rose Walk. I'm seeing Birdman on Saturday.
Oh, yeah. I was going to go today to go watch it. But I just felt so out of it in the morning.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, so I'm gonna go about like Saturday afternoon to see Birdman. But yeah, this week I've seen Rosewater, Interstellar, and Nightcrawler. And I think of and you know what, about Rosewater, it was surprisingly light. Like the movie is about such a heavy subject matter, which is this Iranian journalist gets imprisoned for over 100 days in Iran. He's accused of being a spy, and John Stewart did a really good job of keeping the material really light, because that can become so heavy and so. But he just did a great job showing that this is like essentially it's a bureaucracy like anywhere else. Mm-hmm. You know, they have their superiors and all the bullshit that they have to deal with, and Gael García Bernal I thought did a pretty good job. However, he's not the thinking. I was thinking in the theater that...
Is it an English-speaking role?
It's an English-speaking role. But in the theater, I was thinking to myself, like, he's not the only person I could see in this role. I can't think of anyone else, but I just... To me, he didn't feel like the definitive actor, but he did a good job nonetheless. John Stewart, I thought, for a first-time writer-director, not a bad job. His script, for the most part, was pretty good. I thought... Some characters were really underdeveloped, and then they just suddenly reappear at the end of the film in like a major, like key central role. Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't say central, but definitely is a key role. And then it's just kind of like, oh, I don't care at all about you. And I don't know the actress's name, but yeah, Bahari's wife suddenly becomes an important character at the end of the film. And it's kind of like, oh, well, you weren't really around at all. And now here you are, very important. There's really only one scene between the two of them. Before the story gets going right away, like right away we jump in the middle of the story and the movie backtracks.
What's your interest in seeing that?
In Rosewater, well, I like Gael García Bernal a lot. I think he's a fantastic actor, but mainly John Stewart. I was really curious to see what John Stewart would do as a director and as a writer, because he's never directed anything before. Mm-hmm. And after the movie, it was a Fathom Events broadcast. So after the movie, there was a live Q&A broadcast from New York with Bahari and Jon Stewart, and Stephen Colbert was the moderator, and Jon Stewart said that came about, or his writing and directing the movie came about, because he was just so tired of waiting for a director to come along, because he said it's a long process. Mm-hmm. So he just did it himself to speed it up. And J.J. Abrams actually read the script and gave him some notes.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he asked Abrams if he would read over the script, and so Abrams provided his notes. And so I guess our this kind of goes with our recently seen and our new segment, is that just recently the New Beverly Cinema in Hollywood and Hollywood area has sort of taken on a new era in its existence, and that Quentin Tarantino, who's the owner, has stepped in and become programmer. I believe he's going to be the programmer for the first couple months, and then he's going to have a co-programmer, and then I guess when he starts making The Hateful Eight, he's going to just hand the reins off to someone else. The director...
Is he letting the theater go?
No, he's not letting it go. He's just not going to be programming the films anymore. But saw this documentary by Julia Marchesi called Out of Print, which is an excellent, excellent doc that examines the culture of revival cinemas, specifically focusing on the New Beverly Cinema. And Julia was fired, pretty much, from her position at the New Bev. Apparently she was demoted after Tarantino stepped in as the programmer to concessions, and she wasn't even guaranteed a spot on the schedule so that they could weed her out and force her resignation, but I think they just eventually ended up firing her. And I can say that I personally witnessed an experience in which someone was fired for seemingly no reason. And for that reason, I'm probably never going to go see a movie at the New Bev.
Why did they want to get rid of her, though?
Good question. Good question. It was Tarantino's assistant, her who was sort of taking up a management type position in this theater. He was just kind of overseeing everything.
Just like wanted to.
And she was told, you know, don't talk to Quentin. He knows what's going on. And I don't know. Again, I don't know what the reasoning is behind letting her go. But I believe her side of the story, because her side of the story is really the only one that we've been treated to. I haven't read. They haven't put anything out. Tarantino hasn't talked about it. He's too busy spouting off about The Hateful Eight. So
it is a shame.
Are you? I mean,
I haven't been there. I mean, I do want to go. I'm probably gonna go someday, but I mean, that does suck when you get stories like that from the industry. It's like that story. Remember that we talked about the price fixing for the Pixar people at Pixar.
Oh right.
Like stuff like that. You know, it's the nasty side of the business that like I'd rather not hear about. You know, because it changes like the way you see these people.
True. Yeah, like the new Bev. I mean,
because I wonder. I wonder if we met Christopher Nolan, would he be like an asshole, or would he be like a...
I've met Christopher Nolan.
But like, really, man, you know, like, know him.
I'd like to know Chris Nolan.
Like, get out of here.
Yeah, I don't know, it's just, I think that's such a great deal, and apparently the atmosphere at the New Bev is so awesome. I mean, $8, you get two movies. Everything's a double feature
there. Do they sell out?
The theater's not that big.
Oh, okay. That's
cool. Yeah, so I imagine that they do sell out pretty frequently especially when they have like a big whatever happening.
And they screen really good movies. And
they have really good stuff there.
Like really, really good stuff.
Yeah.
I think they even screened The Thing once, the Howard Hawks one.
Oh yeah, yeah. They do that. Yeah, they do that one quite a bit. They actually had they had the movie Papillon, Steve McQueen, and apparently the print was Tarantino's own personal print, which he said is like is 20 minutes longer than the theatrical editions, because it's like 20 minutes more of close-ups of Steve McQueen.
Oh wow.
But anyway, those are just my 2 cents on that incident at the New Bev, and unfortunately I won't be seeing a movie there ever,
sadly.
Yeah, but I don't know. Go tell me how it is.
Yeah,
tell me how it is.
But nothing in our solar system can help us. Now you need to tell me what your plan is to save the world.
We're not meant to save the world. We're meant to leave it. And this is the mission we were trained for.
I've got kids, Professor.
Get out there and save them.
I have no idea when you're coming back.
In the near future, Earth has been devastated by drought and famine, causing a scarcity in food and extreme changes in climate. When humanity is facing extinction, a mysterious rip in the space-time continuum is discovered, giving mankind the opportunity to widen its lifespan. A group of explorers must travel beyond our solar system in search of a planet that can sustain life. The crew of the Endurance are required to think bigger and go further than any human in history as they embark on an interstellar voyage into the unknown. Coop, the pilot of the Endurance, must decide between seeing his children again and the future of the human race.
Ever since we saw it last week, I've thought a lot about it, and my views of it have gone down significantly. First and foremost, what do you rate this film?
Eight,
right?
Solid eight.
I give it an 8. But I feel like I'm giving 2 ratings. Like, visually, it bumps up to an 8. But without, like, what it is, you know, like a space movie, I think I would rate it a 6. Like, I think that the space scenes are spectacular. And I think there's, like, intense interest in watching that for me. Because I'm such a space geek. I don't know. There was just some things I didn't like about it. I didn't like the whole daughter angle, the dad and daughter angle, how they kept like pushing that idea of love. I didn't like the scene in the black hole. I thought that was so bizarre. But visually, it's fantastic to look at. Like, I think it's a masterpiece. Like, that whole sequence is amazing. But I also feel divided by it, because I think it's such a weird... I think like the whole like idea of love is like underdeveloped. I don't think it's a good notion to push in terms of like how significant this is for like humanity, not just for like this one girl, you know? How he kept wanting, I mean, of course he wants to go see his daughter, but I think there's like much bigger like notions at play in like in the context of the film. Like
saving the goddamn human race.
Yeah, like that's important. I don't want to talk bad about this film because I think it's a marvel, you know. And I often keep thinking, like, could you imagine if someone like, you know, Galileo could like watch this movie, you know, what would he think of it? And then here we are, you know, like privileged enough to see like pictures of space and like even these types of films.
Land on a fucking comet.
There we go.
That's traveling 41,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And what was on the Yahoo homepage when I logged on yesterday? Kim Kardashian's ass.
Her big booty.
Her ass is not even able to escape our podcast, but mainly because we're complaining about it. Because
her ass is out of this world. But so far, like, I think the film, I think the film is great. I don't think the film is going to win screenplay award or a...
We talked about this in the car, so...
Or acting, or it's definitely going to, it should win, like, a special effect, visual effects, a sound effects.
Sound design.
Watching it in IMAX was spectacular. Like, when they're in the cockpit, the sound system in the Chinese theater is so good that, like, literally everything was just,
you
like, shaking
feel
so
in your
much.
Chest. Yeah.
I mean, that's why, things like that, I think that's what makes the movie good for me. It's, like, just seeing them in space, but, like, the story itself... I thought it was very bland.
I think that we had the privilege, like you said, of seeing it in 70mm IMAX, and I feel really sorry for everyone else that's going to go see this like projected in 4K, or even if you're seeing it in 35. I think the IMAX experience literally is half
it's
the experience.
The roof.
It was just so unbelievably amazing to see on this size of a screen and with that sound system, like you said. And I totally agree with you that the love idea is underdeveloped, and
not developed in a wise kind of way. You know?
Yeah, I'll go into why I think this movie is a solid 8 in a moment.
Were you let down?
Actually, no. I'm concerned because The Dark Knight Rises, I thought for the most part was good. It reminded me a lot of Batman Begins.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is actually the direct sequel to Batman Begins. It skips... The Dark Knight is almost like its own independent of that story type film. And then The Dark Knight Rises is a response to Batman Begins. And a sort of response to The Dark Knight because Harvey Dent is somewhat involved in that. But would you agree that the third act of The Dark Knight Rises is the weakest act of that film?
Yeah.
And to me, this kind of felt... like a 3-hour version of the third act of The Dark Knight Rises.
Mm-hmm.
Good, but not extremely good.
Mm-hmm.
And so my concern now is, like, is Chris Nolan and his brother, Jonah, are they getting sloppy?
Mm-hmm.
That's, like, that's my concern now.
Are they going to become M. Night Shyamalan?
because, like, you said that...
I don't think that they are going to get sloppy, or I don't... See, it feels so weird talking bad about this film because, like, I enjoyed it a lot, but...
We should just get out what we don't like about it right away and then...
Like, the sentimental aspect of it, I didn't like about that.
Really?
I didn't like anything about that. Because, like I said, you know, there's much bigger things at play than just, you know, him and his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Are we going to do spoilers?
Yes, this is a, if you haven't seen, okay, so right here, at this very point, if you have not seen Interstellar, what the hell are you doing listening to this podcast? You should go see this movie immediately.
And if you.
Because not just because, like we're saying right now, we're getting our negative thoughts out of the way about it, but a movie like this needs to be absolutely celebrated.
And analyzed.
And analyzed, yes. So, okay, there's your PSA. If you haven't seen Interstellar, do yourself a favor and go see this.
8 out of 10 for me. Could have been better story-wise, visually. It's amazing.
Yeah.
That's my pre-sport review.
Anyway, so... Like you said, the love angle, right? I actually really like that at the core of this giant, massive space film is a story that's, like, so personal and so small
mm-hmm.
that anyone can relate to it. Like, you know, the relationship
yeah.
between a father and his children. Like the love thing that you pointed out, it is extremely freaking underdeveloped and
mm-hmm.
not really done in a coherent way.
Like, I think it's okay to have those types of subplots in these movies because it's what connects you to the events. I think like the way that this that idea was developed, like I would have liked to have seen that he would have died, you know, and maybe like him going back in that little like what is it, the Tesseract or whatever, or mm-hmm. the black hole,
yeah,
like maybe that was his way of like seeing her again and like contacting her or like telling her like I love you or like whatever, you know, and like her realizing okay he did come back and so and so, you know.
There is a rumor going around online and no one hasn't addressed it, he's only addressed the plot holes, mm-hmm. but that he did die. That once he goes into Gargantua, that was his death. And mm. then when he goes off into the space station.
Because the end of the whole like act is just so like uplifting, which isn't a bad thing, but it's so uplifting that it takes you out of like the reality of the film, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because like everything's solved, like he saw his daughter.
So first and foremost, let me get this plot hole out of the way, because I do not, if you have an explanation for this, let me know. But this is the biggest thing that's bothered me about the movie. Okay, so Michael Caine, the almighty Michael Caine, plays Professor Brand, who's Anne Hathaway's father in the film, and you know he's part of the now, you know, tiny NASA, and they realize that humanity's fucked, we're doomed, we need to get off this planet, and so he's working on this equation to break gravity, right, so that we can lift these Elysium type space stations mm-hmm. into the atmosphere and or into space and save all these. Of the population of the Earth, and then Plan B is the bomb. Well, he spent his life's work trying to solve this equation, right? Mm-hmm. And it's determined in the film that before that McConaughey and the Endurance and everybody left on their mission, he had solved it. But he only solved half mm-hmm. because they needed the information from inside the black hole, and obviously that's not possible because of mm-hmm. it's a black hole. Jessica Chastain, right, her character Murph, grows up. She, too, becomes like an astrophysicist or whatever, physicist, working on the same equation. So her life's work is also the same as Brand's, and she doesn't notice that something's up
mm-hmm.
unless he was keeping his notes a secret from her. It's like, did he just work on this at home and everything on the board was bullcrap? But mm-hmm. that to me, is the biggest flaw in the movie. Like, so now we have a second person also now dedicating their life to solving this equation and saving humanity, and she doesn't notice that something's up, that either it's already been solved or it's starting to make sense
mm-hmm.
or it doesn't make sense or whatever. But that was like, what? Seriously? Like you didn't see this? I don't know. That to me was the biggest, like, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
That and how Matt Damon spent you know, Matt Damon was in that sleepy chamber for the length of time until they found him. And then they open him up, and he's, like, you know, gone bonkers. And the other guy on the Endurance, when they go down onto the water planet, was alone for 23 years, and yet he somehow didn't go bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he woke up a couple of times, so, you know, it's assumed he went asleep for 10 years at a time. That's still 3 years he was awake,
mm-hmm.
being by himself.
How long was Matt Damon on there?
Well, if they spent 23 years on the Endurance coming back from the planet, plus the time that the Lazarus missions had taken off when they initially sent everyone out to their respective planet, we're talking about like over 23 years. So mm-hmm. like somewhere between like...
I didn't mind like that so much because I think everyone's going to react differently to...
Yeah.
Because I always feel like... I always feel like even the smartest people are going to make, like, the dumbest decisions.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like in Prometheus. Like that. But
anyways, yeah, so my main problem with the with Interstellar is the script. It felt like the script mm-hmm. was sort of, I guess they worked on it enough to where they felt, okay, I've worked on it enough to, it's where I want it. It's, you know, Nolan said it's still the movie I want to make, and Jonathan Nolan, well... Jonathan Nolan's involvement, I wonder what it is, because he wrote this movie when Spielberg was going to direct it.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote the script when Spielberg was still attached to direct. Spielberg left, and then Jonathan Nolan offered it to Chris, and that's when he took it, and he himself, I guess, did a rewrite of the script.
Oh, he did, yeah.
So that's generally how they've worked in the past. except in Inception, which to me is by far one of the most perfect film plots I've ever seen. Nolan was working on that for like 10 years. So he was working on that for ages before it finally got made, so I'm not surprised that any kinks he had were worked out, and I'm sure other people took a look at it, either his friends or Jonah or other writers gave him input. I'd be astounded if they didn't over a 10-year period working on it. But Interstellar, the script too has existed for a long time, but Christopher Nolan's involvement with it has only been in the last few years. I guess in terms of the plot is just really sloppy.
Yeah.
Let's move on to another aspect of it. What did you think of Matthew McConaughey in the film?
I thought he was good. I don't think it's like an Oscar-worthy performance, but I don't think the film is trying to push, you know, these type of like amazing performances. It's more about the science than about the drama.
And that's amazing too. Mm-hmm. That I got that impression as well, that Nolan is putting the science before mm-hmm. the drama. Which is amazing. What the hell is he trying to tell us? Go read a book.
I know, right?
But I think McConaughey is so great at just being like that everyman, even mm-hmm. though he's not, even though he's like, you know, super tall and looks like a superhero. But he's just so good at just being mm-hmm. that average Joe
yeah.
that you would buy that he was a former astronaut who had to turn to farming.
Maybe because, it's the accent.
Yeah. All right, all right, all right.
That's good grounds in Earth.
Matthew That's McConaughey funny. Drives a Lincoln in space before anyone told That's him funny. To drive a Lincoln.
For me, this film is all about the technical aspect of it. Like the music, the wormhole scene. I feel like this movie is like 2001 if it had a plot. Like if like a plot was like injected into
2001 or a more linear plot at least. Yeah, that I do have to admit, though, for, you know, such a weird film, I actually really like the test. You know, okay, my problems with the movie aren't, I guess I'm not as picky with, going back to the plot. My problems aren't as picky with the plot when Cooper enters Gargantua.
Mm-hmm.
Because plainly and simply, we don't know what the hell's going to happen when you go inside a black hole. For all we know, you do really enter a tesseract and you can see every second of, you can actually see every second of every moment of your life. For all we know. But
maybe, and this is getting kind of like metaphysical, maybe spirits are like the only things that can enter black holes. Maybe that's why he's dead.
Yeah.
Because gravity's not going to harm your...
But yeah, I thought so with all of that, I was like fine, because I was really just curious to see like, are you gonna cheat us or mm-hmm. or are you gonna give us something interesting inside the Tesseract? But the Tesseract was actually really cool. I thought it was neat. It was like a different way of looking at something we've been seeing for like forever now, which is his bookshelf. So I don't really have a problem with that too much. My problem really lies in the whole establishment of the mission. That's where my problem with the movie lies. Not so much everything else that comes after, but just the way that they go about establishing him as the pilot. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Nolan's editing.
Mm-hmm.
His style is very much, here's a simple idea, we're going to jump right into the middle of this complex idea. Like, it's very obvious that Cooper discovered these coordinates, right? Mm-hmm. Because his fifth dimensional self led him to the NASA installation. So he discovers these coordinates. And then at NASA, they determined that he was one of the best pilots that they ever had. So he would be a perfect fit for this mission, because they said that the other astronauts that they had been attempting to use didn't even get past the simulator. So he's really well qualified. But we don't get all of that. It's just kind mm-hmm. of like, you were the best pilot we've ever had. Boom, you're going to fly. Mm-hmm. It just kind of appears like if you blink and you miss it, or if you don't connect the dots, it's going to just completely go over you that they just got him immediately to take this
it's
mission.
It's like the exposition is left out. Which
yeah.
is like usually normal in
Following. Even though Following is really, really dialogue heavy, a lot of the exposition is seemingly left out. Or, you know, we'll just, these characters interact and they go with whatever the hell's going on. It's just, I'm confused by what he's trying to draw attention to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like if you leave out this much exposition.
Even, you know, what would have been interesting is seeing the girl have a life. You know, because
mm-hmm.
at the end, she has like a lot of grandkids. She's married.
She has a huge family.
Like, she's just so angry with her father. Like, I read like a, I don't know if it was like a review on IMDb, but somebody wrote that, we've all been a brat once. Which is like basically her story, just being a little like punk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Great movie. Just, I wish the.
the plot was a little
more... I think Contact's better.
Well-rounded.
Contact better. Yeah, I think Contact is a better movie.
But I... Oh, man. John Lithgow. God damn it. Just talk about a fantastic actor. Just a man who brings his absolute A-game to any role, no matter how small. He plays Cooper's father, or Cooper's father-in-law. He's the father of McConaughey's widow in this movie. What did you think of the visual effects?
I thought that was like the most amazing part of the film. Like, it's so interesting to see now how in this day and age we're able to, like, you know, go to space. Like, even if it's like simulated, it's close to like reality that we'll ever like even. And like I said, you know, being in that theater felt like you were in the cockpit. Mm-hmm. It was literally shaking.
Which is amazing, because that's what Nolan set out to achieve. He said he wanted to shoot it in a way where it felt like the audience was in the cockpit with these mm-hmm. characters. I saw this really interesting interview where he said that he didn't want to... He said when he went into it, he didn't want to use any green or blue screen. Mm-hmm. He said he wanted to actually have, like, if the actors were on a spaceship and they looked out the window, he wanted them to be able to see space. So he said what they ended up building was a lot closer to simulators than to sets.
Oh, okay.
So he really wanted to go for, like, as authentic a feel as possible. And he said they had a lot of zero-G experience from Inception. Mm-hmm. So he knew, you know, and, like, what to use where. Something impressive that he said was... In Inception, and I guess he used it on Interstellar as well, he said that there are certain techniques that you can use to create the effect of zero-G, like wires and cables and all that stuff, and then you just digitally erase them. Well, he said that there are several ways. He didn't go into detail because I guess he was trying not to be technical and just like press junket. Mm-hmm. But he said that he didn't want to do one way consistently for an entire production because that then the audience would start to figure it out. Or he said if you kept changing the methods up, you would confuse them a lot more. So he said he took the same approach to Interstellar. But I agree with you. Like, that whole, like, gargantua sequence, mm-hmm. that was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
I think Stanley Kubrick would have, like, shit in his pants yeah. if he could have seen that black hole done in that way, which apparently is the most accurate representation of a black hole ever done for a film.
Mm-hmm. I think, like, they even said, like, they learned some things from it, from the mm-hmm. researchers doing it.
Yeah, Kip Thorne, he actually published after they did the visual effects.
Well, he wrote a book about it, too, right?
He wrote a paper yeah. on the black holes and how they, what they, I guess, their experiences, what mm-hmm. they learned scientifically for Interstellar, trying to recreate it. Which is absolutely amazing. That well, he's the whole reason why this movie got made. Kip mm-hmm. Thorne, who ended up producing it, because he said he wanted to do a movie about relativity and time travel and space. And I believe it was Carl Sagan who set him up on a date with one of the producers on Contact.
Oh, okay.
And so then they on this date or whatever, he at some point ended up saying, "Well, you know, I have a theory. This could work for a film." And then Jonathan Nolan wrote it. And either Jonathan Nolan wrote it and then Spielberg came aboard, or Spielberg came aboard and then he got Jonathan Nolan to write it. It was one of those two. Mm-hmm. And so it's really because of his, you know, theories and stuff about black holes that this film came to be. So I guess in that aspect, it's not really surprising that the science behind the film is like what drives it, mm-hmm. which is still amazing.
Yeah. And like that scene when they're in the wormhole, that...
Oh yeah, when they enter the wormhole. Amazing. Yeah, that was incredible.
But I love how like that that whole scene is put together. Like you have like that score by Hans Zimmer.
Hans.
Like, you know, like in like Inception. I don't know. It kind of makes me think I wish Contact could have those type of scenes.
Yeah. You know?
Like I would love for someone to like go redo it again.
A Contact rescore by Hans Zimmer. And like, don't tempt him, he'll do it.
Because in Contact, they're only in space for like 20 minutes, you know.
Oh, okay.
You know?
What did you think of Hans Zimmer's music?
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Very Philip Glass.
Very, yeah, very, very Philip Glass. What's the name of the movie that...
Koyaanisqatsi Scottsdale.
He's been working on the score to this movie since 2012.
Oh, has he really?
Yeah, and I guess Christopher Nolan, he was having dinner with Chris Nolan and I think their wives, and so Nolan said, I'm going to be working on a movie, and I'm going to give you an envelope, and inside the envelope is the core of our story, and I'll give you one day.
That's funny.
And you do, you come up with something in that one day, and then we'll get together and we'll talk about it. And mm-hmm. Zimmer, you know, said, yeah, let's do it. So I guess Christopher Nolan gave him this envelope, and inside the envelope was the story. And so Hans Zimmer wrote, which ended up, I guess, becoming the Interstellar theme, which can be mm-hmm. heard in Our Destiny Lies Above Us, mm-hmm. I believe is the name of the track. And so then Christopher Nolan came to his studio and heard what he had done in this one day, and he told him, this is Interstellar. And Zimmer's reaction was like, what? It needs to be this epic space adventure? And he mm-hmm. goes, no, because it's a very personal film at heart mm-hmm. about the father and the daughter, even though it wasn't done quite well. But mm-hmm. But I thought Zimmer's music, I don't know if he just goes the extra mile for Nolan, or because he's been working on this for two, he had been working on it for 2 years.
Maybe because Nolan lets him have that freedom, you know.
Okay, now a little bit of background. There was a point in my life where I thought Hans Zimmer could do no wrong, and I loved, you know, anything with his name on it. I don't know what happened. That suddenly I noticed his stuff became very repetitive, and it was just very ho hum. And then Man of Steel came along, and that sort of solidified it for me that he was mm-hmm. just so terrible. And I just thought Man of Steel was like a rock musician's attempt to do minimalism with an orchestra, and he's absolutely dropped the ball on it. I thought Man of Steel was a terrible, terrible score. Mm-hmm. I think. And even on its own, it's so boring and nothing happens in it that on its own, it's also terrible.
Like, you can't even listen to it again because it's so boring.
Yeah, it's copy-paste. It's literally the same thing happening over and over and over. And, you know, just typical Zimmer, like huge drums, huge overproduced brass section. But for this, Nolan said it's time to put away the big drums. Mm-hmm. And so the focal point of the score really becomes this Harrison four-manual organ, which he recorded in the UK. And it's just the most insane sound. Yeah, it sounds really sound.
Pretty. Especially, like, next to, like, those space images. Like, when they're, when he's trying to dock the ship to that spinning thing.
Yeah.
And then there's, like, that score, like, with the organs. It came together pretty good.
It definitely gave the movie that sort of extra kick in the pants. Mm-hmm. Especially, like, the scene where Matt Damon, Dr. Mann, is attempting to dock. And the ship has been, you know, they have those security measures in place. He's attempting to dock, and I think in that scene is just a really simple little, like, mm-hmm. line that sort of, it's really hypnotizing because there he's trying to create the tension, sort of the suspense to whether, what or like, as to what's going to happen when he actually docks. I just thought it was so unbelievably good. After going for the longest time not hearing a single thing that I've liked by him, I just think also he'll do pretty much any project that mm-hmm. comes his way that's, like, big. He did Amazing Spider-Man 2, which is...
Oh, he did? That's true. I didn't think that score was good.
Yeah.
Did you watch the movie already?
I haven't seen the movie, but I did hear the music. And that was awful. I think I don't think he should be allowed to work with Pharrell Williams. Or
Pharrell Williams score.
Yeah, don't let Pharrell Williams score a movie. Or Junkie XL.
So...
Which is ridiculous. And it was just announced the other day that Batman v Superman, coming out in 2016, is going to be scored by both Junkie XL and Hans Zimmer.
Isn't that weird? He scored Dark Knight. Get someone else to do it.
Yeah, I guess the reason why they're going to have the two of them is because Zimmer is going to focus on all of the Superman aspects of the score, mm-hmm. and he's going to further develop the quote-unquote themes. He's going to do that, and then Junkie XL is going to handle all the Batman stuff, since Zimmer already
sounds like shit already
did that. Oh, God.
I think, like, they're doing a bad job with the DC universe.
We need to save that for another podcast.
That's a long 2-hour discussion. So, with Interstellar, did you understand, like, at the end what happened to the girl? Is she dead, too?
Who, Anne Hathaway? Or? Yeah. No, I don't know. I haven't
because
really...
Because you're talking about how he died, but it looked like he was going to go get her.
Yeah. I don't know. I need to read into... I have to admit, I didn't read into the death theory like mm-hmm. that. I haven't read into it that much. Because personally, I think... I see the movie is as we saw it, that he did survive. That mm-hmm. the black hole did somehow amazingly spit him back out with only seconds of air left or minutes mm-hmm. of air left or whatever. and that he, that Anne Hathaway, was on this other planet with that other doctor, and that they, I guess they dropped that bomb. I don't know. It's just the ending was, the ending is extremely hopeful, and I like that, to think that.
Yeah, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with
because
that.
I seriously went into this movie thinking like they're gonna die. If someone's gonna like McConaughey's gonna die, or like one of the major characters like Anne Hathaway, someone's gonna like bite the bullet, and and that's what's ultimately gonna save humanity. But the fact that he survived, and it's like, you know, so this like really hopeful type message is nice to show that, you know, in the face of like, you know, this insane problem, this huge problem, we can, people really can make a difference.
I don't think there's nothing wrong with, like, you know, these films like War of the Worlds, you know, where Tom Cruise like reunites with his son. I don't think there's nothing wrong with that. It's always nice to have those endings, but I wish like in Interstellar you would have had like, it would have connected more with like the audience. Like, who were the beings? Were they even beings in the movie?
The like the fifth dimension people. Yeah, like I thought it was just, or them, they.
Because that's something that I don't even understand either. I mean,
and I think that is one of the aspects of the script.
That's what I didn't like about it. That, I would have liked for there to be like signs of like other life.
But I think that's one of the aspects of the script that we're not meant to understand. I think that's one of the aspects of the story where I got right away like, okay, I think this is one of the things that Chris Nolan is going to want us to debate about. Who put the black hole there? Or excuse me, not the black hole, the wormhole.
The wormhole. Yeah.
Yeah, who put the wormhole there? It's like, that's not really answered. And I think that is one aspect of the movie that is like sort of like the, like
up for grabs,
like who did it, and that's one of the sort of topical aspects, is who put the wormhole there.
See, that's the big, those, like, when I watch space movies, those are the big questions, you know? But with this one, like, there's not even a hint of it, of there being...
You know, I'm kind of glad they didn't address it, though, because I actually had that thought when we went into it. It was like, are there going to be aliens in this movie? And there was a rumor that there were aliens in the film.
Yeah, have you read Spielberg's treatment for it?
No.
I don't know where I read it online, but they listed all these things, and... I think when they went on a planet, like one of the planets had like aliens who were like trying to kill them. I think so.
I'm glad that didn't make it into this movie, because it's been done so many times, and it's so
the,
like,
evil aliens.
Yeah, and it's so expected, because in theory, if a civilization could, you know, travel across all this great distance in space, odds are they would probably want to destroy us rather than, you know, they'd probably want to cultivate us for their use or whatever. But I think I'm glad that they left the extraterrestrial life element out. If anything, it's interdimensional, because they already showed that you can sort of cross dimensions with gravity, which I actually thought was an interesting concept. And I think that's another one, that another seed that Nolan dropped to kind of like let that sink in, which I guess, if you know, depending on whether you like this movie or not, you could think it's totally stupid. But I thought that was an interesting concept, that the only thing that can travel across all dimensions is gravity. Is that a nod to Alfonso Cuarón there?
It could be.
Is that a little wink of the eye?
Maybe like George Clooney is still like floating.
That's George Clooney was the one who put the wormhole there. Okay, now here's my thoughts. Even though we have all these problems with Interstellar and we hoped it would be better, the reason why this movie is an 8 is because this movie, this picture, had a Transformers-sized budget. Shot, you know, so much IMAX. And Christopher Nolan is such an asshole to theater. I'm sure theater chains hate him because everyone's trying to go digital, and Nolan's like, no, I want you to hang on to your film projectors to screen this.
I think there was like only like 15 theaters in the United States that were showing 70.
Yeah, I think it was something like 41 IMAX theaters across the country were showing it in 70 millimeter. And,
41?
Yeah, and like you said, only like about a dozen or so were doing 70 millimeter, and I think only about 204 showing it in 35.
Yeah,
that's
crazy,
insane. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, but like I should have put this, talked about this earlier, but I saw that documentary that you were talking about, Side by Side. They show like all the directors talking about how convenient digital is, and then they ask Nolan, he's like, what? It's just not convincing me, dude.
Like, fuck all of you.
With this film, you know, it kind of like, I always wonder, like, we talk about how great film is and like all these things, but can the average moviegoer walk into a theater and then know that they're watching a film? Like, know the art of what they're watching, you know?
So here's a question for all of you that listen to us. go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet at me if you're on Twitter. You can find me at Eduardo Victory. Can you tell the difference between when you see a film print and when you see a digital print or a digital projection? And I think now might be too late to really ask that, because the majority of theaters now do digital. So anybody out there, if you'd like to chime in your thoughts, please, you know, get in touch with us. And we'll include that.
Like, for me, it's just like that film look looks really like cool. You
know? This it gave the movie a texture that just it. I don't.
Like the colors. The.
I personally wouldn't even want to see this digitally. It'd be so clean and be looks. It looks so computer generated that it's like I have no interest in seeing it digitally. But yeah, there's just that texture of the film gave it such a,
like, the contrast, the colors, the sound, the crispness of it.
Yeah, it was just
the grain. You know,
I noticed that the grain was really prevalent in a lot of the grain was brought out a lot more in the earth scenes. Yeah, that was definitely brought out a lot more, I guess, to get that dirt and grittiness aspect of it. But because a movie of this size has come along, this needs to be celebrated.
Yeah.
Because Christopher Nolan has given us a massive, like, summer blockbuster type film, but it's forcing people to think. Even if you're trying to pick apart the plot holes,
like, it's still something interesting that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's like, I think that is his true achievement with Interstellar. Not that he made the next 2001 or anything like that, but that he has inspired conversation about film, about digital, and about the topic of Interstellar, the topics of Interstellar itself, you know, the climate, the space travel. That is why this movie should be celebrated.
Yeah,
because it's such a I don't know if you and I are ever going to get to see another 70 millimeter IMAX movie after
probably
this.
Probably not.
This is probably it.
Now that, like, you're talking about this, how the fuck does Big Hero 6 become number one? Is that what that movie's called?
Big Hero 6, yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Let me check those numbers. I don't know by how much.
I think they're close, like 50.
They both opened 50, I think, didn't they?
I think Big Hero 6 got like 5 million more or something.
It looks like Big Hero 6 opened 56.2, Interstellar 47.5
Jesus
million.
Jesus Christ.
That's quite the margin.
Yeah.
And I think the reason why is, well, Big Hero 6, anyone can go to that.
I think that this whole film debate is happening because, like, we as audiences are letting, like, we basically vote with our dollars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If there were more people who, like, knew, I don't want to say that they don't know, but who were more aware of, like, the art of movies.
People need to be cult. Okay.
Culture, yeah.
We can't. I can't speak for everyone else, because if you live in a city like Los Angeles, like New York, but where we live, which is a suburb of Los Angeles, we live in this town, Oxnard. It's about an hour northwest of L.A. People here need more freaking culture.
Mm-hmm.
People here are absolutely uncultured.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I mean, just knowing, like, about these things, I don't think, like, of course it's not vital to your existence, but it does protect, like, the culture, you know?
Yeah, and however, you know, Big Hero 6 is number one here in the U.S. However, globally, Interstellar did open at number one.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, so, like, it's obviously this film's being accepted by, yeah, I don't know.
Hopefully the culture survives or something. I don't know, it's interesting to see where it's going to go.
So do you have any final thoughts on Interstellar?
8 out of 10 for me. I not disappointed by it. I liked it. But I wonder if it's going to be the next 2001. I'm going to say no.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. I think Under the Skin is more 2001. But that's okay. It's still pretty good. I can't wait to see it again.
I'm glad that
I think I'm going to see it on